We will appeal this court ruling. We will continue the fight in court against this attempt by the right wing and big business to have a do-over of our election victory last year. We will also take the fight on the street.
The words of Councilmember Shama Sawant, talking about a recall effort that is moving into the next phase after a court hearing last week. We're going to talk a little bit more about that case, the council's decision to use city resources to back her up in court. A lot happening with that one. But hey, everybody, welcome back to Seattle News, Views, and Brews. Feeling great on episode 38. I'm your host, Brian Callanan, and I am also a Seattle Channel host. I should point that out. The fun never stops with this job, I tell you. But the views expressed here on the podcast are my own. Joining me, the man, the myth, the legend, Kevin Schofield from Seattle City Council Insight. Kevin, how are you, sir?
I'm good. It's been an exhausting week, but
yeah, that's where the legend comes from. You've been working hard. All right. Our background noise sponsor for the audio podcast, City Grind Espresso from the first floor of City Hall. They are closed, of course, during the pandemic, but we thank them for their support. We also need your support on Patreon, folks, really do out there, to keep this show rolling. So please contribute, and thank you to all of you who do. Some special content always happening for patrons here. We had some on the West Seattle Bridge last week. Hope you listened to that. Always more coming. Thanks also to Converge Media for the video version of this podcast. Let's get started with right here, right now. All right, so what's happening right now in Seattle politics? A big question as the deadline is up for the Seattle City Council to respond to Mayor Jenny Durkin's veto of their rebalanced budget package. The mayor's main issues there around laying off police officers, as we've discussed before, and changing the SPD's budget. So this veto came up on August 21st. I'm counting about 30 days or so. Here we are, September 21st, this week ahead here. It really is go time. Kevin, this is going to be a very delicate path to tread for the council and mayor, hammering out this agreement ahead. What are you foreseeing there?
At this point, I have no idea. There's been radio silence on both sides for 2 weeks on this since the council came back from their summer recess. Uh-huh. And, I would assume they're continuing to talk, behind the scenes. And Councilperson Gonzalez and Councilmember Mosqueda, who's the budget chair, have both said that, there's conversations going on behind the scenes, but nothing from either side. So
is it one of those kind of deals where they can't really punt, because I know they have to put together a balanced budget here. But I know that budget for 2021 is right around the corner. On the 29th, they're going to start up that process. How does that factor into whatever is going to happen here over this next week?
Well, it certainly factors in a lot on the staff of both the council and, the mayor and the city budget office, right? Yeah. Because, if they're still negotiating on a 2020 budget, then somebody's got to go do all the math on that.
Yeah.
At the same time, they're doing the math on the 2021 budget.
Right.
Now,
right.
It is interesting that they've made it a little easier on themselves, because normally this year they'd be doing a two-year budget.
Right. It's just a one-year process.
21 and 22. Yeah. But they changed the rules for themselves and said, now this year we're just going to do a one-year budget.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little different.
Yeah.
And hopefully a little bit, the second year, the 2 years out thing, it's always been a little iffy.
Yeah.
They do it, but no one really takes it serious, because they know the next year is, they're going to redo a bunch of stuff. So it's an interesting projection of here's what revenues and expenses, mm-hmm. Things that we start doing now, assuming they can carry forward. There's in budgeting, there's this thing called the bow wave effect, right? Where if you hire somebody mid-year this year, it's going to cost so much for 6 months of paying them. But then next year, you're going to have to pay them for a full year. So it's going to be more expensive next year. So
understanding
kind of what that bow wave effect is of hiring and other things, other new programs you start up is really, really important.
Yeah, Captain Schofield talking about the bow wave. I love it. I did want to point out, I actually talked with Interim Chief Diaz last week on Seattle Channel. I hope people can check out the show on City Inside Out. And we covered some good ground. I asked this question with him, one-on-one with him, if he would consider laying off officers, or even much less the idea of laying off officers out of order of seniority, like the council was asking him for. Former Police Chief Best for. His response was, he's focused on keeping the department whole. It just seems like, Kevin, with this whole, the crux of the issue here really being the police department budget and how that impacts the overall budget for the city, feels like we've gone from a discussion of the council saying we need to cut officers because more than half of our 911 calls do not have crime involved, to the chief and the mayor's push, saying we need to improve response to those 911 calls so we can make sure we're getting to different neighborhoods more quickly. These cuts to the police department should not be happening. How did these sides get so polarized is my question.
Well, I mean, I think there's a kind of some connective tissue in between those, and that once again, it comes back to this notion of, well, okay, you know, we I think everybody agrees there's broad consensus that we ask SPD to do too much, and that we need to find other programs to do a bunch of these things. Mm-hmm. But there isn't actually the plan to do that yet. Mm-hmm. So it to a lot of folks, it seems premature to start cutting SPD now until we know, you know, who we're going to ask to do that other work and whether they're staffed up to do it. Right. And so we get, you know, that comes, you know, full circle back around to 911 response times.
Yeah.
Right? If we cut police now and we actually, and all those calls that we want to go to other people are still going to SPD for the moment.
Yeah.
Their response time is going to get worse.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Right?
There's, but you know, I think there's one other budget issue that we make sure that, you know, just we get clarity on.
Yeah. Let's touch on
what's going with the mayor and the council, and that's the reserve funds.
Yeah. Right?
Where, you know, the council wanted to spend a lot of the money this year. That's in fact, almost all of it.
Yeah.
And the mayor said that's irresponsible because we think that the revenue deficits this year are going to continue into next year and maybe even worse.
Right.
And the COVID-related expenses are going to be really high next year as well.
Right. I think the council really put in a lot of eggs in the basket of that Jumpstart Seattle program for that additional tax on the payroll of the higher earning companies there. I think the council really bullish on that. The mayor, not so much. I think she's anticipating potentially a legal challenge there ahead for that.
Hey, there's a legal challenge, and it's also a question of, well, how much revenue is that
really going to bring in? Yeah, yeah. That's
and we see Amazon, you know, expanding in Bellevue, not so much in Seattle right now. So it's like, well, what will that really bring in?
Yeah, well, we'll see. I wanted to point out, too, concurrently to this whole budget discussion here, we've got something coming up next week with the Uber and Lyft minimum wage, a committee meeting coming up this week with Councilmember Mosqueda talking about this effort toward this minimum wage for the transportation network companies, the TNCs out there. She's talking about moving this out of committee, so we're getting real here on a fairly controversial piece of legislation. And, Kevin, we've touched on this before, but I want to talk about this right now. Uber, Lyft, not doing well in terms of revenue right now. Is it time to put some extra taxes on them? And still a lot of questions over, does this legislation that the council has put out, does it really help all of the drivers out there or just the full-time ones? Your thoughts?
Well, it is definitely skewed towards the full-time drivers.
Yeah.
The way it's set up right now is the council and the mayor want to pay drivers for all the time they're spending in what they call working. And that includes what they call P1 time, which is the time that they're sitting in the cars with their, you know, signed into the app, waiting to get a call, to get assigned to a pickup somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a lot of time. It could be a small amount of time. And a lot of that depends not only on the demand, but on how many of the drivers are signed into the app, right?
Yep.
Because they're you know, sharing sourcing for all those.
Right.
So since the mayor and the city council want, and this is what happened in New York City, want to pay Uber, Uber and Lyft drivers for that time that they're spent waiting for a call.
Mm-hmm.
That is a strong disincentive to Uber and Lyft to actually have a bunch of drivers.
Yeah. Right.
So,
right.
So, you know, what they did in New York City using a similar, but you know, a couple ways, little sort of nuance different, but very, very similar kind of minimum wage standard is Uber and Lyft basically capped the number of drivers who can be assigned in at any given time.
Yeah.
And that really, makes, it's a preferential choice for the full-time drivers.
Yeah.
So really disadvantages part-time drivers.
Wow. And just the whole concept of why we have these app-based services to begin with. I mean, the taxi cabs, I know those are capped at a certain number or whatever else in our city. And now we're talking about this. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's built into Uber and Lyft's business model that they're really built around, you know, this is mostly a job for a lot of part-time drivers.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the city and city council in New York City, you know, will say, no, we want it to be a great full-time job for people who want to do this full-time.
Wow.
So you want them to be able to have benefits. You want them to, you know, get paid a living wage, all those things. And it will be, according to the penalty going right now, to the detriment of part-time drivers, right? Yeah. Who are doing this as a second job, you know, as a side gig to try to help make ends meet, right?
Right, right.
And in it, you know, it's interesting both for, you know, public policy for the city to be saying, okay, we are advantaging full-time drivers over part-time drivers, and, you know, basically picking winners there.
Yeah.
But also telling Uber and Lyft, okay, no, your business model can't be built around part-time drivers. It has to be built around full-time drivers.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a little weird.
Yeah,
That they're doing that. So,
yeah.
You know, there's going to be lawsuits around this too.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Really changes kind of the whole structure of the gig economy and how we consider it, I think, in many ways, if you want to break it apart that way. I wanted to touch on one more piece with this, Kevin. This is going to mean some more work for the Office of Labor Standards for the City of Seattle. I noticed in between the last two versions of the legislation, creeping up a little bit. At first, it was about $500,000. Now it's looking like over $600,000 to make sure that there are annual appropriations to support four new positions for this. So the OLS, working very hard as it is now going to be working even harder. They need four new people to do this. And this sounds like it's really complex, not just rides in Seattle, but originating in Seattle and things of that nature. This is going to be quite a task, I think, for OLS to tackle.
Yeah, and they've had a lot of work put on their plates, right?
Yeah.
We've had, you know, hotel worker, you know, legislation that's come out of, you know, Initiative 124 and then gotten rewritten. You know, they've just been asked to take on a lot in the last year.
Sick and safe leave, yeah, you name it.
Sick and safe leave, all the, you know, there's some really groundbreaking workers' rights bills that have been passed by this council. And they really get laid at the feet of OLS. And you know, it's unclear whether anybody's sort of taken a comprehensive look at all this and said, okay, is OLS really staffed up to do all this work?
Right, right.
You know, they keep, they for some of these bills, they incrementally add some more budget to OLS. For some of them, they don't.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know,
it's
that's a big question, right?
Yeah,
especially in a time when we're in a budget crunch.
I was going to say, difficult time to be talking about ads when we're talking about cuts in so many parts of the budget right now. So a lot ahead for OLS, a lot ahead for the city council as they discuss that. Let's move on to Now Hear This. Okay, so last week, the city council approved paying with city funds the legal defense for council member Shama Sawant, as they would with any other council member, says council member Andrew Lewis.
This isn't about endorsing anybody's decisions or speculating on the merits of any legal allegations. This is about respecting the process and maintaining an important precedent. And it is a slippery slope if we start picking and choosing who does or doesn't receive these kinds of legal representations.
So the council voted 7-1 to approve this move. About $75,000 worth of funding is what it looks like it'll be for Councilmember Sawant's defense in this recall effort against her. Councilmember Juarez, the lone no vote. She had wanted to discuss Councilmember Sawant's use of city property, etc., during the protest this summer. One of the points brought up during the recall effort, which we'll get to in a minute. And Kevin, I know this is one of those pro forma type of legal discussions that the council does when something like this happens. It happened back in 2011 with Richard Conlon when he was supporting the underground tunnel back in the day. But it is difficult to separate the politics, I think, from this when Councilmember Sawant is involved. Your thoughts about that?
Well, and you know, she is certainly of the belief that, you know, all decisions are political decisions.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
A little bit. This is sort of coming back to bite her right now.
Yeah, right.
And the, you know, the other city council members, all of them are like, you know, said, you know, no, this isn't political, right? But this is a, you know, a straightforward thing.
Doesn't mean we agree or disagree, etc. Yeah.
The state law, there was a little bit of a confusion about it, and the reason the war is voted no is you know, they got city attorney's opinion on sort of how to interpret some vague parts of the state law.
Right.
On this. And Juarez, who is an attorney and former judge,
yep,
read it differently. And she said, you know, in the council meeting, she said, I've read it myself. I have a different interpretation of what the city attorney's office is saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that really comes down to the part that she was reading, that the city attorney's office said, no, you read this to say that, you know, basically, if she requests it, then the council can approve it. Right.
Wow.
And what Juarez said, there's another part of the law which looks to me like it applies, which says that we need to weigh whether, you know, a reasonable person would believe that these actions that are being challenged in the recall, she did as part of you know, an expectation for things that she would do in office.
Yes, yes.
So the split between Juarez and the other seven council members, Sawant, of course, was recused from voting on this.
Yes, right.
And wasn't even present for the meeting.
Right, right.
The split between Juarez and the other seven was really about, okay, how do you read this law? Do we leave with the city attorney's offices? Mm-hmm. Do we believe, you know, go with Juarez's interpretation? They just kind of, and the ones who went with the city attorney, it's like, well, this is just straightforward, basically.
Right, right.
She requested it, and it doesn't say we have to. Mm-hmm. You know, they had an out.
Yeah.
They didn't officially have to do it.
Yeah.
But again, it comes back to there was precedent with Sawant's predecessor, Richard Conlon.
Yes, right.
Now, it's interesting, you know, the mayor has gone down a different route. She is
She is paying for her own.
Office,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Check with her office. She is actually paying for her own legal defense.
Yep. 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 So that's a different difference within these two recall campaigns here. But I want to try to talk about the Sawant court case itself, if we could, Kevin. So Judge Jim Rogers certified these four charges from the recall petition. He says factually and legally sufficient with these to proceed to the signature gathering phase of the recall effort. I want to talk about some of the legal lines that have been drawn here, because, Kevin, you did a great piece on this in SEC Insight. Really seemed like the judge was picking the defense arguments apart here.
Yeah. And quite honestly, I didn't think even going into that hearing, they were particularly strong arguments.
Mm, okay.
There's a lot of arguing technicalities, like, all the specific detail have to be in the original petition that the petitioner submitted.
Right.
Or can, you know, you can expand on that in, you know, legal briefs that come, you know, before the hearing.
Yeah.
And, you know. So a bunch of technicalities on that, a bunch of like crazy hand wiping. No, look over here.
And, yeah, and the political screed argument.
This is a political screed against against Council Member Sawant by her detractors.
Yes, right.
But you know, at the end of the day, the attorney for the petitioner, John McCabe, former U.S. attorney for Western Washington.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Who is actually
appointed during
Jenny Durkin's predecessor in that role.
You're right. Mm-hmm.
He basically just hammered on the facts.
Yeah.
He didn't even really spend a lot of time on the legal theory and kind of legal justification. He just really hammered on the facts on this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the judge said, okay. So once has said that she is going to appeal it, which will go like with Durkin's appeal, straight to the state Supreme Court.
Right. I wanted to move on to another huge story from the end of last week. The Office of Professional Accountability now starting to put out reports about their reviews of police officer conduct during the early days of protests after George Floyd's death. Let's talk about these two high-profile cases, Kevin, that are going to get a lot of scrutiny. One where an officer had a knee on a protester's neck, if we can tackle that first, and then the other where a young child was pepper sprayed by an officer. So the knee on the neck case, I know you went into detail on this with the OPA director, Andrew Meyerberg.
That's right. And, you know, and I got a chance to look at the reports from the OPA on this that they published last Friday.
Yeah.
So everybody can look at it now.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically, you know, and in some ways, you know, it looks bad from the beginning because it's just a few days after the murder of George Floyd.
Yes.
Where an officer put
his knee on the neck. Yeah.
On the neck for 8.5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was clear that he was restricting the breathing of George Floyd.
Yeah.
And there was nothing else going on. You know, things were calm around them.
Right.
They just
sat
there for 8.5 minutes like that.
Yeah.
And
this was different. What, yeah, definitely a lot more chaos and etc.
What OPA director Meyerberg said was this is, you know, different on a number of different levels.
Mm-hmm.
It was a chaotic situation right there. You know, the officer, a number of other officers, it was right outside the T-Mobile store. They were, you know, arresting people as they were, you know, as looters were coming out of the store,
yeah,
arresting them, putting them on the ground in what they call prone handcuffing position on their stomach. So they could, you know, and then holding them down. So they could handcuff them and then, you know, immediately moving on to the next person once that person was secured.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this incident lasted not 8.5 minutes, but 13 seconds.
Yeah, 13 seconds,
beginning
right.
13 seconds. And what SPD officers are trained to do in those situations where they're prone handcuffing somebody is put their knee kind of right in between the top of the shoulder blades.
Right? Yeah, right behind or right below the neck.
Below the base of the neck, right? And is clear from the video, according to Director Meyerberg, that the officer did in fact put his knee on the neck. But when they talked to the when they talked to the officer who was doing it, he thought he'd put his knee at the sort of base of the neck, top of the
proper
shoulders.
Spot. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The officer who was actually sort of handcuffing the suspect, you know, heard protesters nearby shouting, "Take your knee off his neck, take your knee off his neck."
Right.
And looked over and moved the officer's knee kind of farther down.
Yeah.
So he clearly saw that it looked wrong from there.
But, right.
So what they said was, look, it was a clear violation. The knee was on the neck, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So they sustained that. But it was not at all clear that the officer was trying to restrict his breathing by putting the knee on the neck. So in terms of that part of the complaint, they found it unfounded.
Got it.
Now, this officer also made a whole bunch of incredibly unprofessional comments that were caught on body-worn video.
Yes.
Sort of before and after that particular incident. Mm-hmm. And those are all sustained as well. So he's facing discipline now for a bunch of unprofessional conduct and for violating the training by putting the knee on the neck.
Yeah. But I wanted to talk about this other piece here, Kevin, with regard to a young boy who was pepper sprayed. 13,000 complaints coming in about this one case. So many people saw this viral video of a young boy crying, getting milk poured on his eyes, et cetera, after this pepper spray incident happened. I know that Andrew Meyerberg went back and forth on this, and they put together a long discussion about what happened here, but they have not found that officers acted inappropriately here, and that's difficult for a lot of people to hear.
Yeah, and there's a lot to break down here, and it is really, really difficult. And Director Meyerberg, you know, told me that he felt very conflicted and about this particular incident. So first of all, you know, let's talk about the video that went viral on this, right, on social media that, you know, generated 13,000 complaints.
Yes.
The video does not show the pepper spray.
Yeah, it shows
several seconds after the pepper spraying, the boy, an aide person pouring milk on his face and him crying and screaming. The OPA investigators tried to contact the father and son to interview them.
Yes.
They referred OPA to their attorney.
Yes, right.
They contacted the attorney. The attorney never got back to them. So they never actually had an opportunity to interview the father and son.
Got this. It.
What they did get, and, you know, let's remember, of the 13,000 complaints, almost none of them were people who actually witnessed the event.
Right.
There were just people who saw the video online,
didn't
like it, and emailed OPA. So what OPA did was they went and they collected body cam video from a bunch of officers who were there and sort of pieced together from different angles what happened.
Yep.
In fact, they released a 5-minute video, which is a compilation of those different ones.
Yes.
Now, there's a couple pieces. At what happened at first when that video went out was some people on social media identified a particular officer.
Yes.
It turns out it was not that officer. That officer was standing about 15 feet off to the right of where it was.
Yeah.
And one of the videos that they show in this compilation is a body-worn video from that officer.
Right. He clearly not using pepper spray at all in this incident.
Right. Yeah. So when you look at all these videos, and I encourage everybody to go look at all the video, watch it 10 times.
Yes.
I got to watch it, you know, with Director Meyerberg.
Yeah.
And then him sort of narrating what he and his team kind of went through and pieced together with all of this. You see what started was a protester being arrested in the 15 feet over to the right area.
Yeah.
Right. And the officers had sort of been planning that for a little bit because that protester had allegedly tried to steal someone's, an officer's pepper spray can earlier in the day.
Yes. Right.
So they sort of approached slowly and then suddenly made a move to go grab him and arrest him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That caused a stir in the crowd. The rest of the officers on the line all said, move back, move back.
Yep.
Right. Over the course of, you know, 10, 15 seconds, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You see in the videos, one woman wearing a white shirt kind of move from the left side into the middle, kind of right into the front.
Right.
And she starts sort of shouting and pushing at an officer there, grabs his baton and starts a tug of war with him over this.
Right? Yes.
And in the meantime, while that's going on, the father and son had moved right behind
that woman. Yes.
And in fact, you know, you could see the father, but you actually couldn't see the son. You know, he was really obscure. And and that's important because the officers could not see.
Yeah.
So then what happened was while this tug of war is going on, a supervisor comes running out behind the officer who's in this tug of war with the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And over his shoulder, the supervisor is the one who does the pepper spray, and he pepper sprays the woman.
Right.
When he pepper sprays her, after a moment, she ducks and turns.
Right.
And it, some of it deflects, some of the pepper spray deflects off of him, clearly onto the father, probably onto the child.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And that's how it happened. And so, and there's like five different angles in this video compilation that you can see all of this from. And so what OPA concluded from this was that it was an appropriate use of pepper spray because this woman, protester, was in fact engaged, you know, in a struggle with the police officer.
Right.
Right. And there, you know, there were not a lot of good alternatives for how to subdue her.
Yeah.
And then they said the officer clearly did not target the boy. In fact, couldn't even see that the boy was there.
Right, right, right.
And so they did not sustain the complaint against the officer for pepper spraying the boy.
Right, right. And I know that was something that Director Meyerberg had a lot of angst about. But I think it really does raise that larger question of when should pepper spray be used? I know Black Lives Matter has said, let's just use it in these specific indications when it's a one-on-one type deal.
Right.
That would basically take it out of any crowd control situation altogether, with that, which I think some people would say, great. But I think that's the big question here.
That's exactly what Black Lives Matter, Seattle King County, asked Judge Richard Jones to do with the injunction back earlier in the summer,
Right.
is to say, you know, the pepper spray should only be used in situations when there is no risk of splash onto other people.
Yeah.
Like exactly what happened in this situation. Crowds where people are just close by, splash is inevitable.
Yeah.
And Judge Jones said, no, I'm not going to do that. And one of the big issues around this is that this is the larger context of, you know, less lethal weapons are mandated for the police to have and be trained on.
Yeah.
So that they have an alternative to going to, you know, batons
or guns or whatever else. Yeah,
guns
right.
And lethal force.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we one by one take away all of these other alternatives, they have nothing left.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not a great option for them to exist. In fact, it's probably a bad option.
Right.
But it may be a better option than them not having it. Right. And I'm not saying, I'm not saying I necessarily agree.
Nope, I understand what you're saying.
This is a super, super complicated issue where people can have valid, you know, viewpoints all over the spectrum on this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But there is absolutely that issue too. That,
yeah.
Like that this case raises that of, hey, you know, should they be using pepper spray?
Yeah.
In you know, crowd control cases, and it raises a larger issue with that that both the OPA and the Office of Inspector General have raised.
Yep.
Around crowd control tactics and
yeah.
the fact that there is no law enforcement agency in the country that has figured out if you have a small number of bad actors in a large piece of crowd,
right?
How do you extract them without disrupting the crowd?
No,
right? Nobody's figured that out.
Right? No.
And OPA Director Meyerberg in his report to the council and to Judge Robart, you know, called for innovation. He said, look, we got to go figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? That's
nobody's figured it out yet.
No, they haven't. And I know we're going to see more reports from the OPA over the next several weeks here. And we're going to talk more about those as they come out.
Yeah, they're expecting to put out 5 to 10 every 2 weeks.
Got it. Got it. We'll keep tabs on what's going on there. Let's move on to what's next. All right. Pier 58, whole lot of shaking going on there last week. A collapse, two workers injured as the city tried to take this piece of the waterfront park apart here. Some really scary pictures to watch there, Kevin. Very fortunate no one else was hurt. Very fortunate the aquarium right there didn't get damaged, etc. But in looking at this, Kevin, the city had a series of reports about just how dangerous this pier was over the last several years. They'd cranked up the demolition schedule a few weeks ago, as we know. But this idea to defer any maintenance on this pier over the last several years because it was going to be torn down anyway, that's the decision that I think is a real challenge here.
And there's a couple levels to that, right?
Yeah.
So in the late 70s and 80s, there were some pier collapses, wooden pier collapses along the waterfront in Seattle. And so in 1990, the Department of Construction Inspections passed a director's rule, which basically put in place a waterfront pier management maintenance regime, including that wooden, you know, all the wooden components of a pier needed to be inspected every five years.
Right, right,
right. And, you know, one of the issues with Pier 58, well, you know, they've been doing those inspections on all the wooden components every 5 years.
Right.
And, you know, and they were deteriorating. They were very clearly deteriorating.
Yes.
And they, you know, projected out how bad it was going to be. Mm-hmm. And it looked like it was going to, you know, be at an end of its life right around the time that they were planning on basically, you know, demolishing the entire thing and replacing it as part of the whole waterfront renewal process.
Yes.
Anyway,
right.
Basically 2 years from now.
Right? Yeah.
The goal is let's get it through 2 years, you know, to 2022. We're going to tear it down and we're going to replace it. They've got funding in place for that.
Yeah.
You know, that was basically all set to do.
Yeah.
Now, the problem here was the components that failed on Pier 58 that caused this collapse, and in fact caused them to close it a few weeks ago when they saw it starting to move away from the seawall.
Yeah.
Were not the wooden components. There's a whole section you can probably remember of on the north terrace of Waterfront Park. Mm-hmm. That's concrete. It's got the Fitzgerald fountain on it. It's gorgeous.
Yep.
And that's all – it's concrete pier. And below that is supported by steel beams and what they call monotubes, which are steel tubes filled with concrete.
Right.
Those failed. What happened was the caps right at the top of those pilings, right where it meets the concrete pier, you know, above it, failed. And basically the pier just started sliding to the left.
Yeah.
And it was pulling the rest of the pier with it.
Yep.
That's what pulled it away from the seawall.
Yeah.
And so when they went in to demolish it, they had to go basically start with that.
Yeah.
They were just basically finishing up getting all the decorative components so they could start pulling out some of the other you know, pieces of the fountain and all that, when a concrete section basically just collapsed straight down and it pulled the rest of the concrete part with it. So all the concrete part is all underwater now.
Yeah, right.
But it does
huge headache. You know, yeah.
Certainly from a policy issue, it says, hey, look, somebody needs to go back and look at this, you know,
absolutely
this ancient, you know, pure maintenance policy and say, you know, why does it just say the wood components, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And
you got to look at all the components, right?
10 years ago, they did do an inspection of all the components of Pier 58. But 5 years ago, they just looked at the wooden ones. They didn't look at these other ones.
And that's
done a hard look. You know, it may be that 5 years ago, they certainly knew 10 years ago that there was corrosion.
Yes.
In the concrete part of it as well.
Right.
But 5 years ago, they don't have any data on how that was.
Wow. So,
you know, it seems like it's a really good case for saying that policy needs to change.
Yeah.
That needs to be updated. So they're really looking at every single component of those waterfront piers.
Right. And we're going to keep an eye on that over the next couple of weeks, too. But we're running short on time here, Kevin. So I wanted to make sure as we wrap up the Coffee Break podcast here with something sweet every now and then, a treat here. This is actually, you probably heard the fork move in there. This is actually a cake from my birthday that my daughter just made for me. Happy birthday to me.
So hey, happy birthday.
Thank you.
It's a chocolate
cake. But this is the chocolate beet cake. Mouth-watering as I get close to it. So my mom made this for me when I was a kid. I was like, oh, awesome. These are chocolate chips. And she said, yeah, that's right, kid. Keep on eating that. Full of beets. These little chips in here, all beets. I got to say, it makes for something so sweet when you eat it there. I really do still think it's chocolate, and it's one of the moistest, most awesome cakes of all time. So
you can't beat it, huh?
Yeah. Ah, I see what you did there.
Just punishing you on your birthday.
No. Thanks. I better have a bite of this while I still can. That is good stuff. Kevin, I always love your insights on all things baking and all things civically inclined. I really do appreciate you being here. Thanks a lot.
And thanks to you, Brian.
Okay. Next time you want to know what's happening in local politics, give us a listen here on Seattle News, Views, and Brews. Find out what's brewing. You can subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Please support us on Patreon if you like what you're hearing. And thank you so much for listening. Thanks also for watching on Converge Media. We'll see you next time. Seattle News, Views, and Brews is an independent production of Callinan Media Services. Copyright 2020.